Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And before we get going today, I wanted to give a brief shout out to a really cool project that Monster Professor alum Pinkney Benedict has been putting together with his MFA students at SIUC, that's Southern Illinois University Carbondale, their creative writing program. They've got a really cool audio project going on called Blanket Fort Radio Theater. You can find that at WSIU.org and NPR1. They've teamed up with SIU Press and the local radio station, NPR affiliate, and they're putting out some really cool audio versions of books and publications that SIU Press has worked with. So check that out, NPR1 or WSIU.org. Now, when I said this is a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond, you didn't hear in theater or on the stage there. Why not? It should have been on there. Shouldn't it have? I mean, monsters were not only an important element in the theater since the beginning of theater, but the monsters in theater had a major influence on monsters as we know them. Well, I need to remedy that, and the one who can do it is my guest today, Dr. Michael Chimmers. He's professor of dramatic literature and theater arts at University of California, Santa Cruz, where he also won Excellence in Teaching Award. He's also director of graduate studies there. And he's the author of the book, The Monster in Theater History, This Thing of Darkness, which is a really cool book that I'm going to refer to a couple times in this conversation, among other books, Towards a Theory of Mime. He wrote Ghost Light, an introductory handbook for dramaturgy, even a book on the American Freak Show, Staging Stigma, Critical Examination of the American Freak Show. Before being at the University of California, Santa Cruz, he was professor of dramatic literature at Carnegie Mellon's University School of Drama. At one point, he was director of digital arts and new media program there at University of California, Santa Cruz. He's written on a wide range of subjects. For instance, he's written authored chapters and books on South Park, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Game of Thrones. He's got some really cool projects going on. One in particular was of interest and complete surprise to me that we find out toward the end of the episode. I think you're going to like that. I think you're going to love this whole conversation. We get into some really cool categories of monsters as he sees them. I learn a lot about the monsters in theater history. We go all over the place. Yeah, we jump into Rocky Horror Picture Show, among other things, and robots and vampires and werewolves and you name it. I think it's a really fun conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. So here we go. Well, thank you so much for joining me here on The Monster Professor, Dr. Michael Chimmers.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan, and I'm very happy to be on the show.
You're a scholar of a lot of different theatrical subjects. One of your books, Ghost Light, an introductory handbook for dramaturgy. That was actually published by the place I went to school for my MFA, SIUC, Carbondale Press, which is a fantastic right. press, by the way. You've got stuff on, even all the way to South Park, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Game of Thrones. But I know you specifically as the author of The Monster in Theater History, A Thing of Darkness. And so maybe I could start you off by picking your brain a little bit about what got you so fascinated with monsters of all things that you are, into in the theatrical tradition? Or maybe a better question is, like, when did you realize that monsters were your thing? And sub question, is it true, this rumor I heard about you, that you teach sometimes, give lectures in a full werewolf costume?
All of these things are true. Yes, it is true. I teach a class every year here at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And it's called Monsters in the Dramatic Imagination. And it's a course that usually serves between 350 and 400 students from a variety of backgrounds. I mean, I've got theater majors in there, but I've also got literature, history majors, psychology, sociology, biology, computational media students, computer science students, engineers, partially because it's a general education credit, but I think also because the discourse of monsters is widely interdisciplinary and intertextual. It's a place where we can all sort of meet together, different disciplines and different, because we all have some experience of monsters and we all have some kind of, I think, to a greater or lesser degree, deep psychological reaction to them. And I just happen to be very interested in exploring that. One of the things that I hope we get a chance to talk about today, Josh, is the quality that performance has of embodying into a living way, into a living form, these concepts that we talk about. So, you know, I listened, for instance, to some of your interviews with Pinckney Benedict, and, you know, it's this fascinating work that he does in creative writing and in cultural analysis. But very few scholars have really looked into the performance of monsters. And I think this is because we tend to focus on the folklore and then the literature and then the cinema. And we skip over the theatrical part of it, which usually is a very important part of it. And one of the things that I'm always shocked about is people say, oh my gosh, the monster in the 1931 James Whale Frankenstein with Boris Karloff is so different from the monster in the book. And anyone who thinks that that is a shocking thing is someone who has not investigated the 100 years of live theater performance that has Frankenstein as a centerpiece. In which you can see very clearly how he transforms from the literary figure, who's very complex and multi-layered and speaks like a poet, to the lumbering giant, you know, who is inarticulate. And so as a result, we miss out on a huge component of the research that can be very enlightening to us and how cultural concepts like monsters change over time. So for me, this is a long way of answering your question, why do I dress up as a werewolf when I'm teaching? And it has to do with this embodiment. It has to do with actually bringing the experience of the monster into a certain reality, right? When we read about monsters, or even when we go to the cinema and watch monsters on the screen, we enter into a fantasy realm that we know is not a real realm. When we watch theater pieces, when we watch live embodied performance, those actually exist. You know, not as photons hitting a screen or as images in our imagination generated from interaction with literature, but they actually do exist. There actually is something happening in real life, in real time, in the space that I'm in. And that gives, or no longer anymore, we can't be in the same space anymore because of the COVID plague, but we're working on that in theater. We're adapting. But
if you don't mind my jumping in there at the embodiment idea, I mean, that's a lot to unpack there. It's a lot of really fascinating ideas. And you know, this is going to lead me jump us right into a later question I had for you right away, because I'm fascinated by this idea of embodiment of the monster. And you're exactly right. How many of us are interested in monsters completely skip over the theatrical tradition. One of the reasons I was so excited to talk with you is because I haven't really I haven't really gone into that realm on this podcast yet. And I say it's a show in which we, you know, discuss and explore monsters in literature, film, myth, folklore, culture. Why don't I have theater on there? I have no idea. I'm trying to remedy that right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's because there aren't very many people who are doing that kind of work, you know. But yeah. Here I am. So I'll tell you everything I know.
Cause, I mean, because you're exactly right about this. In your book, but also as you're saying now, like even something as specific as the Frankenstein monster, it is a theatrical creation. Like what we get out of Mary Shelley is a very different kind of thing than what lives in everybody's minds now when they think of the Frankenstein monster. And that comes from that theatrical tradition. It's actually one of the pieces I think I've been missing every time I've discussed the Frankenstein monster. Yeah. And I love this idea of embodying, because as a fiction writer, I find myself embodying, you know, what I'm trying to create on the page too. Like if my characters are going through some sort of action movement through a room, I very often catch myself going through the actions I'm trying to describe physically.
There you go. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I guess one of my questions for you is, since that embodiment is essential to the theater, or vice versa, or there's that inextricable connection between the two, how does that change the monster that appears on the stage versus the monster that appears on film? Like, is there a distinction for you between the monster that you get on the stage, or what a playwright would create for us, and what a filmmaker would create for us?
Well, you know, I mean, this is an interesting phenomenon that I think that we as professors, as teachers, as educators, that we are really coming to appreciate right now. Because most of us, although we're very lucky to be able to continue our work, we were talking about this earlier, we now have to teach on Zoom. And what we discover is that Zoom, although it does enable us to do our work at a very basic level, we miss out on a tremendous amount of rigor and engagement with our students. It's very difficult, for instance, to tell if the students are getting it. Especially if they've turned off their videos, which most of my students do. It's very difficult to tell if a student is falling behind, so that you could then maybe single that student out and say, hey, you know, why don't you come to my office hours and we can talk about what's troubling you on this. You know, it's very difficult to sort of connect with your individual students. I feel like my experience of teaching on Zoom is pouring a lot of energy into this screen and not getting very much back. And this is a phenomenon that I think is directly related to this concept of embodiment. When we embody, when we are present in an actual physical space, we are communicating much more information back and forth between one another. Because of course, as you know, communication is not just words, is not just symbols. It's gesture, it's costume, it's lighting, it's place, space, and most importantly, it's context. And we have right now, as professors, we've been robbed of the context of the university. I don't say robbed. I mean, we don't get to have it. And I think we now can realize what a great privilege it is to have the context of the university, in which the students are working, they're living this very privileged, isolated life inside the university, and that creates a certain context for how we do our work. We are missing all of that when we have to teach on Zoom. So I think that this is a good example, a good parallel, if you will, between what happens when we watch a movie, which can be very exciting. Don't get me wrong. I love movies. But watching a movie is very exciting, but it's all sort of done for you. You're not exchanging information with a movie. And with a book, it's the same thing in a way. I mean, I feel like when I read a novel, when I read a piece of fiction, I engage much more deeply with it than I do watching a movie. And I create these very exciting images in my head, which in some cases can be extremely detailed and deeply emotionally evocative. When I think about, you know, when I think about my relationship with a character like Frodo from Lord of the Rings, you know, like I have such a deep relationship with this guy, and he doesn't exist anywhere except in my head, right? But when a monster or when a character appears in front of you in the same space as you, it grants a level of actual existence to that fantasy world that has been created by the author. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And in that actual existence, a tremendously, a much greater amount of information is exchanged. And so that's why we have the, we talk about it as being a rich experience, right? We say, oh, that experience was so rich. What that means is it's full of detail and depth and nuance. And I believe that there is something unique about embodiment that, and don't get me wrong, I'm not dissing fiction or film. I love both of those deeply, but they are different experiences. And I think that this is really where we get down to it, that there's something about actual presence that we just, as humans, don't have a substitute for yet. We may get to the point where the technology is good enough that it can mimic presence enough so that we are, that we can engage at that level through digital technology, but we're just not there yet.
Yeah, and is my very poor awareness of theatrical history, am I right on in thinking that, you know, some of the most iconic monsters that we know of really kind of found their footing and got their training on the stage? For instance, like Bela Lugosi's version of Dracula is the Dracula that most people imagine. And, you know, didn't Todd Browning like pull him from the stage onto the screen? Is that right?
Absolutely. Bela Lugosi was a stage actor. He was trained as a stage actor, and he was performing as Dracula in the Hamilton Dean version of Dracula that was in London. And I think it was also in New York. Not 100% on that. But that was the play that was bought by Universal Pictures, and then adapted into a film. It's the same thing with Frankenstein. Frankenstein was in London. It was a play by Peggy Webling. And that was purchased and adapted into the first film, the 1931 film. Interestingly, Bela Lugosi was playing the monster in Frankenstein on stage as well. And they actually shot a version of Frankenstein in which Bela Lugosi was the monster, but they decided to go with Boris Karloff instead, which is one of the reasons why those two actors always sort of had it in for each other.
Have you seen that copy? I didn't even know of that recorded copy.
No, I don't know if it's available for anyone to see, but I'm not a film scholar. So I'll have to defer to a film scholar on that.
We're going to have to stage a heist of Universal Studios just to get a copy of that thing.
Oh, I am in. I am in. I'll be the demolitions expert. I'm in. I don't know anything about demolitions. That's what I know about heists.
Everybody has to have their specialty. All right. Well, we're going to make that happen.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that's maybe I can just jump around. I want you to give us a brief tour, because I really like the categories of the monster on the stage that you have. But you know what? Maybe since I'm going there, let's go there, because we've brought up at least Dracula, which is very much of this vampire category. You also think in terms of like the ghost, the beast, and the kind of wolfman beast, and also the construct, which seems really important, especially now in our modern world, with everything robotic, but also that, you know, the robot got its start on theater, right? In theater. So,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so maybe could you give us kind of a brief tour of these kind of categories of monsters on stage and how you perceive of them, to really sure. find their meaning.
Sure. So if there is a general theory of monsters, it is Jeffrey Jerome Cohen's essay, Monster Culture Seven Theses, which appears in an anthology that he wrote called Monster Theory back in 1996. And this essay is deeply foundational for me, and I think for most people who are doing monster studies right now. All your listeners should read it. It's not
really
very
good.
Long.
Yeah,
it's great. You know about it? Yeah. So, Dr. Cohen was kind enough to blurb my book when it came out. So it was really gratifying for me to get that validation from such a person who had been so influential to me. But as you know, in this essay, Cohen identifies all monsters as, he calls it harbingers of category crisis, which means that they embody a unified binary that normally shouldn't be unified, right? That they embody two contradictory states of being. And in the case of the vampire, those states are alive and dead, right? So in our normal lives, we think of a very clear boundary between things that are alive and things that are dead. But I think, if you read Freud's The Uncanny, we fear that those boundaries are not as clear as we think that they might be. So when Freud is talking about the experience of the uncanny, which I think of as a kind of a flavor of horror, he's talking about looking at a thing and not being sure whether it's alive or dead, or whether it's real or artificial, or natural or artificial. So you have, as a modern or modernist concern about the increase of technology in our lives, Mary Shelley's monster comes right into the beginning of that. Although I think I should just briefly point out that Mary Shelley titles her book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, right?
Yeah.
But she never again mentions Prometheus at any point in the entire book. So that's another thing that I think that very few Frankenstein scholars have looked at. Knowing what we know about Mary Shelley and her circle, Percy Shelley and Lord Byron, of course, and what they were reading, I think that the only Prometheus that she could be referring to is the character Prometheus in the Aeschylus play Prometheus Bound. So really, Frankenstein in that sense has roots in the theater, even though it itself is a novel. But within 3 years of the publication of the novel, the first pirated illegal, I mean, they weren't illegal because they didn't have copyright laws, but the first pirated versions of the play started coming out in the London theater. And then pretty soon they were all over the place. And a year after the first serious Frankensteins came out, there were farce Frankensteins coming out. So, and we could talk about the relationship between humor and horror maybe on another edition of the podcast, but...
Yeah, that's a line that is too thin to maybe even really exist there. And I don't think I've fully jumped into it as much as I want to yet. But so maybe we'll have to have you back on for that too.
Oh, I'd love to. I'm just finishing a piece right now for an anthology by Kevin Wetmore and Meredith Conti. And I'm really trying to delve deeply into this. Of course, I'm not the first person to look at that connection, but I'm really trying to get a grip on it. I'd be delighted to come back and talk about that. Throughout the 19th century and into the early 20th century, the Frankenstein story is so popular that it incites a revision in Yiddish literature of the Golem story, which is a much older story. But a total revision of that starts to come out around the turn of the century, in which it's a much more Frankensteinian story, in which the golem goes berserk in the end and has to be destroyed or put down. And then you have in Prague, which is also where the golem stories come from, you have a young writer named Karol Čapek, and he writes a story called RUR, or it's a play called RUR, which stands for Rossum's Universal Robotics. And he uses the Czech word robota, which means drudgery, like scut work. And that's where we get the term robot. It's also very much a Frankenstein story. And this is the first appearance of the word robot. And in it, the robots break free of their constraints and take over the world and kill all the humans. So,
yeah, the very first fully robot story we get is,
that's right.
is so, the same story.
Absolutely. Even, so I, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Even Ambrose Bierce's robot story, which I think predates that, was essentially a robot rising, like a automaton essentially rising up and killing his master. And so there's just no way around robots are going to destroy us.
Well, and I think, you know, if you look in the into the historical context of what was going on at that period of time, there was a lot of, actually, it's kind of similar to another time I might mention, a lot of concern about immigration, a lot of concern about racial differences, and a fear that people who had been long oppressed might rise up and smash the machinery that had oppressed them because, you know, duh, who wouldn't do that? In America, you had, you know, the anti-slavery movement had turned into Jim Crow, and it wasn't very satisfying, you know. And so I think it's interesting to see something like King Kong come out right in the middle of that period, 1930s, in which these explorers go to a exotic, you know, far away mythologized land, and they take someone from that land in chains and put them in downtown New York. And so I think that it's very productive to think of that as a fiction for the anxiety about what, for instance, Black people might do in response to their maltreatment over the centuries. So those are clear and present anxieties that I think manifest themselves in the shape of different monsters. And, you know, we can talk about that for any different monster. But then the other big collision is between human and beast. And humans becoming bestial in some way, that's your werewolf, but also your creature from the Black Lagoon and any number of other creatures where, you know, there's some synthesis between the human and the beast. And that, you know, that addresses a very primal fear, I think, that we all have, that we are, in the end, you know, sort of amoral creatures who will do whatever we can to get what we want, right? Unconstrained by morality or guilt. And I think that's the image of the werewolf that Lon Chaney presents in the early films, also starring Bela Lugosi. A werewolf is a person who lives in dreadful fear 29 days out of the year of what he's going to do on the 30th day, right? When he loses control. And that's all, by the way, totally new. The first time a werewolf is associated with the full moon, I think, is in the 40s. A movie called Curse of the Werewolf, I think. Werewolf of London. Werewolf of London. 1941, I think. That's the first time.
With the flower? Was that one where they had that flower theme?
Exactly, yeah, the moon flower. Yeah, absolutely. That's the first time in recorded history that I have found, and I've been investigating werewolf history back to, you know, the Dacians and the Romans and the ancient Greeks, the first time ever that the phase of the moon has had anything to do with the transformation into the lycanthrope.
Yeah, like it used to be, you needed to be a Roman soldier and then just like circumurinate around your cloak or something, and then you turn into a werewolf.
Exactly. It was usually a process of magic, of some kind of magical spell, you know. And in the 15th and 16th century, especially in Germany, werewolves were prosecuted as a kind of witch. And so one of the things that I've looked at is these trials of werewolves in Germany in the early 15th century, no, excuse me, early 16th century. Late 16th century. they're all through that period, really, but the late 16th century, there was a tremendous upswing in witch trials in that part of Germany, and werewolves were a huge part of this. So, you know, so these the category crises, I think, are a sort of a stable discourse that moves through monster culture. So I think, you know, Cohen was definitely on the ball with that. But at the same time, we also see that monsters respond to very specific anxieties within the cultures that create them, usually.
Because in your book, I think you do a really good job of hearkening back and bringing forward what Cohen did in that essay, and then in that whole anthology is really good. But you're right in that, he seems to be focused on that, sociocultural meaning of the monster. And that in and of itself, of course, I think is reason enough to take studying the monster seriously. Not to take the fun out of it too, because monsters are just plain fun, but I think they matter in that way, but not just socioculturally, like individual psychology is just as vital to the monster. And you also bring up Joseph Roach's surrogate, this idea that it's something about the monster is or seeing it is something akin to reestablishing order out of chaos. And so how does the theater do that for us in particular?
So Roach says that this process of surrogation is a social process by which we deal with our anxieties by not dealing with them, right? So what we do is we have an anxiety, we generate something that is a substitute for that anxiety, So for instance, one of the things that vampires have been accused of since the time of Lord Byron is being queer. Vampiric sexuality. Vampires are usually very, very sexy, which was not the case prior to Lord Byron. Prior to Lord Byron, you would definitely not invite a vampire to your birthday party. They were scary looking. They looked like dead creatures. But in after Lord Byron wrote about them, and then after Lord Byron's friends or his enemies wrote about him in reference to vampires, you sort of get this image of the vampires being a very sexy creature that performs, by the way, humanity, even though it's not a human, right? And as a result, the survival of the vampire is measured by the success of that performance, right? So, so let's just take, for example, vampires as a substitute for queerness, right? So let's say you have an individual fear and a social fear that interact with each other about queer people, perhaps because you secretly feel that you might be one. If you go and see a movie or a play, particularly a play, if you go and see a play in which there's a vampire character who behaves in a queer manner, who is then defeated, right? Then that relieves your anxiety because in a way you say, oh, I've projected my queer feelings or my feelings about queer people onto this vampire. And then the vampire gets a stake through the heart at the end of the play. And I feel better. And Roach says that embodiment is a really important part of this process, right? So the substitution is the first part. Embodiment is the second part. And the third part is repetition, because obviously that doesn't really make the problem go away. It just makes you feel like it went away for a little bit. And I think that that's why people, one of the reasons why people like monsters so much is because seeing the monster be destroyed or beaten at the end of the story is anxiety relieving. But since the real causes of those anxieties are not addressed by some silly little drama, it has to be done again. So surrogation then falls into this process of substitution and then embodiment and then repetition. Substitution, embodiment, repetition. Substitution, embodiment, repetition. Until finally the problem becomes so great that you have to actually have to deal with it. But often dealing with our anxieties is more anxiety provoking than the anxiety themselves, which is why we repress them.
I'm going to be that that annoying student in class who like throws a completely unrelated ingredient in the pot and then force you to deal with it. And so how does Rocky Horror Picture Show fit into that? I'm curious.
Man, are you kidding? This is my home turf, man. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, of course, is not unique in its use of monsters as a way of dealing with queerness. There was a huge surge at the time, because at the same time that you had Rocky Horror, I think just before that, Charles Ludlum came out with his play, The Mystery of Irma Vapp, in which this is an amazing play. If your students or your audience has not seen a version of this play,
I haven't. No, it's new to me. Oh, yeah,
it's so great. The Mystery of Irma Vep. Irma Vep, of course, is an acronym for vampire. And there was a movie, I think, it was a silent film, I think, in the 20s called Irma Vep, about a vampire. That's a wonderful film, but they're not really related. The Mystery of Irma Vep is a play in which two men play 8 different roles, men and women, and they undergo extremely rapid costume changes. There's something like 37 different costume changes, maybe more, within the play. And it's just astonishing. It is so funny. But in this play, in Irma Vep, you have a vampire, a ghost, a werewolf, and a mummy, right? All of which somehow comment on what it is to be gay in America in the 1970s. And Rocky Horror, I think, comes out of that tradition. Rocky Horror, of course, was a play first, long before it was a film. It was a play. And so to have this character, Frankenfurter, right, who embodies not only, you know, semiotics of the Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein. People always say Dr. Frankenstein, but he actually never did get his doctorate. He dropped out of school.
Yeah, he's a dropout. Yeah.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. So Mr. Frankenstein, the scientist, but also Dracula because of his queerness and the fact that he shows up at first wearing this cape that is very evocative of Bela Lugosi's cape in the original Dracula film. And then they go through, and then it's aliens and it's constructs. It's just a wonderful, wonderful film, especially for those of us who, I think I was 15, I think, when I first saw Rocky Horror for the first time in a basement cinema in Salt Lake City, Utah. And that was the middle of the Reagan era and the
in Salt Lake City, of all places. In Salt Lake too, City, yeah. Yeah. Was it one of those interactive things where people were throwing stuff at the screen? Yeah,
definitely, right? So, and that's another thing. I've always looked at Rocky Horror not as a piece of cinema, but as a piece of theater that has a very complicated scenic component, right? Because you don't really get the experience of Rocky Horror just by popping it in your VCR. Nobody has VCRs anymore. Popping it in your or calling it up on Netflix or whatever. And watching it by yourself in your house, that's just dumb. You have to be in a theater with people who are yelling things back and forth at the screen, and there has to be that level of embodiment in order for it to be effective. Otherwise, it's just a silly little, you know, campy sci-fi parody if you just watch it by yourself. But if you watch it with a group of people who are engaged with the performative aspect of it, the theatrical aspect of it, then you get a lot more out of it.
Yeah, and I risk throwing this way off track, but I'll be brief about it. It seems to be, to me, the same experience, or maybe one of the reasons I'm such a big fan of pro wrestling, and why in the quarantines they're just it lost its heart and soul, is that it's essentially a more theatrically violent version of Rocky Horror Picture Show. You have you have your monsters, you have your gleaming mostly naked men wrestling yep. each other. You have monsters.
Totally queer. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. You want to talk about a site for queer monsters? That is. And of course, you can't tell any wrestling fan that, because they'll punch you in the face. But
I won't punch you in the face, and I'm a wrestling fan, because it's all there. I mean, the dark, the scary, the sexy, the crossing the boundaries. It's all there, yeah. and it's happening in front of everybody's eyes. And maybe that does some of that surrogate stuff too. But you know, as you were explaining how that works on the stage. One thing that came to mind, I don't know if you saw it, is this, I think it was a little high school production, well, little high school production. I think it was a high school production of Alien, the 1978 film. And something about that seemed exactly right to me. Like, it's like when I first heard that, like, Evil Dead the musical was showing in Canada, I thought, well, that's cute. That's cute, but it's not right. Like, Evil Dead is a film. But when I heard these kids were trying Alien on stage, I'm like, that's where it needs to be. That makes you feel it even more. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think, you know, Alien is one of those old stories. It's a new science fiction version of, oh my God, we're trapped in the house during the storm and the murderer is one of us, right?
Yeah.
We're trapped with the murderer in the castle, you know, on the moors during a storm and we can't escape, you know? And so there's a very intimate aspect of it, right? It's a deeply intimate story, I think, especially since Cohen talks about the alien monster and how sexual it is. You know, it's got a very phallic head, and then it's got its ovipositor is very phallic. And it turns out that the goo that it drips all the time is actually KY jelly. And that the jaw is made out of shredded up condoms, so that have that elasticity to it. So there's a lot of, like, deeply erotic aspects of the alien, and deeply intimate. And so I think that's why it lends itself really well to a small intimate theater experience. Unlike, say, for instance, Lord of the Rings, which bombed. They did a Lord of the Rings stage play in Canada also, and it just bombed.
There's no, you can't do that. It barely works as a film. If it does, it can't be on stage.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I think that, you know, to examine these, the processes of adaptation from one form to another is really enlightening, to see what works and what doesn't work. But that's really interesting. I had not heard about that production of Alien. That's a little scary for high schoolers to do.
Yeah, and I have no idea how they didn't get the pants sued off of them for doing that, but it ended up getting a lot of support. I think even Sigourney Weaver showed up to a production of it or something like that. It was
wow.
It was pretty cool. You're gonna have to check that out.
I have to research that.
Could I throw you for another loop here? And because I know you've written on the American Freak Show and the circus freaks, and I connect my love, you know, for the circus and carnival freak with the monsters. It's all one thing to me. And I'll just say Todd Browning gets to be my connection between the two. You give us Dracula and freaks, and I absolutely love them both. Am I right to connect the freak show and the monster in theater?
Yes. I mean, you know, you had mentioned when you were giving me that very kind introduction that my work runs a disparate gamut. I've done articles on Game of Thrones and South Park and Rocky Horror and the freak show, as well as dramaturgy. And the funny thing about that is that for me, this is all really just different aspects of one inquiry that I'm making. And it's really about how fear operates in culture. And more importantly than fear, the other side of fear, which is Aristotle called it eleos, which has been translated as compassion or pity. That is what I think is the most important aspect of the work that I do, is I'm looking for how we identify the deviant and therefore punish the deviant, thereby punish the deviant, and then how that could be turned around to increase our ability to have culture affect empathy and fellow feeling and compassion. Because that's how we're gonna get through this life. You know, it appears to me to be, if we're gonna survive as a species, we're gonna have to learn to be more compassionate. And it kind of runs counter to our evolutionary instincts. You know, we find it a lot easier to hate than to love. It takes a lot more energy. But one of the things that, for instance, the work of the philosopher Stephen Asma, who wrote a wonderful book called On Monsters, he connects this to this process to a neurological process in the amygdala that identifies threats. And it's very hard, he says, to teach someone not to be racist. It's very hard to teach somebody, as an example, to put somebody in school and say it's bad to be racist and then don't be racist. If they were raised to be racist, they're not going to be educated out of it. On the other hand, if they see a story in which they identify with a character of a different race and they develop a deeply emotional connection to that character and then watch that character go through trials and tribulations, that might work. That's going to be far more effective in helping that person get over their racist tendencies, just as an example. So the thing about the Freak Show is what I explored, building on the work of others, of course, was that although people in the Freak Show, many of them had extraordinary bodies or some kind of extraordinary behavior, that's not really what they were playing. They weren't playing people with extraordinary bodies. They were playing monsters. So for instance, Grady Stiles becomes the Lobster Boy. Like, there's nothing about him that's a lobster. He's not a lobster. He's a human being. His parents were humans. He just happens to have his hands happen to look like, you know, somebody might say lobster claws. And so they say, oh, he's sort of half man, half lobster. No, that's ridiculous. But he went along with it because he could make money doing it, right? Or the Wolf Boy, you know? You name it.
Like human giant caterpillar and that kind of
human thing. Caterpillar. Yeah. I mean, you name it. Robert Bogdan in his book about freak shows talks about how you could take a tall man and make him into a giant, right? So one of the most famous giants was just a tall man until he went to the circus and somebody said, hey, have you ever thought about becoming a giant, right? And the way that they made him a giant was they dressed him in big cowboy boots, a big cowboy hat, and they posed him with small elephants, right? Like baby elephants. So he just looks really big. Or they posed him next to some very small people, right? Which has the double effect of making the tall man look like a giant and making the shorter man look like a dwarf, right? Rather than a little person, I mean. So the effectiveness of the Freak Show was largely due to the facility for these narratives to work on the extraordinary bodies of people, right? And I'm sort of talking about a best case scenario here. A lot of Freak Show performers were thought of themselves as professionals and had a hand in their own reconditioning and their own sort of semiotic representation. A lot didn't, right? There were a lot of people who didn't have the ability to form consent or who were exploited or even treated as slaves within the Freak Show. So I don't want to excuse the Freak Show, but I do want to, in my work, I sort of try to look at it and see what it really was rather than, you know, just dismiss it as exploitative. It was exploitative, but it was more exploitative of the audience than it was of the people performing.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's to answer your question. That's what it is. The freaks are performing monstrosity, and they're not really monsters. They're really humans, but they're performing monstrosity.
Yeah, as I'm realizing now, I think I've kept you here for at least 40 minutes, and someone is gonna like get furious. Many people might get furious with me if I get the monster and theater expert up here, and I haven't even brought up ghosts, like, you know, Hamlet and Macbeth, and so I'm not giving you much time to talk about ghosts, but we got to bring it up, right? And so tell me a little bit about the ghost on stage.
Absolutely. So, you know, Salman Rushdie described a ghost as a unfinished business, right? And in my book, I describe a ghost as a memory with an agenda, right? So the ghost represents not only the unholy crossing of the boundary between life and death, but also between now and then, right? The ghost is an intrusion of the past into the present, right? So the ghost represents a sort of a time warp. But the thing about ghosts is that, I mean, I don't know about ghosts that people might meet every day walking down the street or, you know, in a haunted house or in a theater, because theaters are very haunted places, people say. Those ghosts are not my business. I'm only interested in cultural ghosts, right? And one of the things that you can say about a cultural ghost is that they are always carrying information. They're always carrying information. They always have some agenda about how they have been remembered, which they think is wrong. And as a result, we've been using ghosts in the theater as devices for getting plot information out since the beginning of theater. There's no question about it. I mean, you can find ghosts in every cultural form of performance all over the world. This is a monster that appears in just about every culture, as far as I can tell. Every culture has some version of a spirit that remains unquiet, and it shows up in the theater, in the performance traditions, in every culture. So it's a very powerful image. And yeah, Hamlet's father's ghost is just one of, I don't know if you know this, but the revenge tragedy that Hamlet is one of, that was a tradition that was already 20 years old when Hamlet was written. And if you look at these other plays that were written even before Hamlet, they're so similar. They all have a ghost that demands revenge. They all have a love interest, a beautiful woman love interest who kills herself. They have a scene where the main character is talking to a skull, and then they have a big duel at the end. You know, so it's a genre. The revenge tragedy is a genre, and the ghost is present in every single one of these, even though he has different characteristics. You know, sometimes he's very engaged with you know, trying to constantly force his son to revenge his death, and sometimes he just sort of lays back and allows God to take revenge in his own time. But or he just shows up once or twice, as he does in Hamlet. But yeah, but no, we're never going to run out of theatrical ghosts. It's such a mainstay because it's so easy to do, right? You just take a regular actor and you whiten his skin or you know, put him in a fright wig or something, or just drape a sheet over him, and now you've got a ghost.
Yeah, I mean, you have to take all these practical considerations into what the story does. We pull off that costume? Yeah.
Absolutely. Josh, one of the reasons why many of the monsters that we think of as being, you know, real mainstays in the West, vampires, the Frankenstein monster, and ghosts, became so popular in the 19th century was because there was an explosion of stage technology that would allow these really cool effects. And one of them was actually called the vampire trap. And this is a sheet of India rubber with a slit in it that you put in the stage. And under normal circumstances, you put a trap door underneath it so that anybody who steps on it does not fall through. But then at a certain point, you remove the trap door. And so when the actor steps on it, he'll drop right off the stage. And then you can put up a flash of smoke or a flash of lightning or something, or a bat, and it looks as if he transforms into it. You can also use it, you can put it up vertically, and you can walk through walls with it. There was also a technique called Pepper's Ghost, which appeared at the same time, where they used mirrors to generate an image of a translucent figure that you could put your hand through, it looked like. So there was an explosion in the 19th century of monster-related theater technology that really, you know, people loved to go see monster plays. They just loved it. Horror is huge in this period. And so that really sets the stage for what we think of modernly as film and television traditions of horror.
Yeah, that must have blown people's minds seeing that kind of technology. I didn't know how that worked. That's really cool.
Yeah, and they actually named them. They named the technology after the monsters that they served. The vampire trap is one of my favorite concepts.
Yeah, well, and thinking about the pragmatics of the stage, I'm curious if you could give us some insight on this, because I really don't know the answer, and I don't remember coming across it anywhere. But why is theater culture so darkly superstitious? You have the break a leg thing and the Macbeth thing and the ghost light that must stay on for the ghost who haunts the theater. Why is theater culture like this, and like so many others, like you know, pure music culture doesn't seem to be as superstitious, or others don't seem to be, but theater yeah, folks are.
I tell you, I have given some thought to this, and yes, theater is extremely super. The theater people tend to be extremely superstitious. I myself have to be very careful when I'm doing my scholarship, because when I'm in the theater space rehearsing as an actor or as a playwright or as a dramaturg, which I often do, I'm much more superstitious than I am when I'm just sitting in my study thinking about what I'm going to write and thinking very, very logically and very critically and analytically about my subjects, right? And I think it's because theater production is extremely precarious. There are so many things that can go wrong. I think in that wonderful movie, Shakespeare in Love, Tom Stoppard has a line where he says, Tom Stoppard was the author, but he has a line that says, theater is a series of unavoidable catastrophes that lead to inevitable disaster. And yet somehow it works and no one knows why. It's a mystery. Right. And I think that that's part of the thrill of working in the theater is its precarity. But theaters themselves are a place where the boundaries between fantasy and reality become murky. And that's not a metaphor. That's true, right? I mean, this place that you go to is the theater, but it is also, in a non-trivial way, Agincourt, right? I don't know, you know, the forest in Midsummer Night's Dream or the forest of Arden, right? It is that place. It is also the theater that you went to, right? Where last month you saw The Importance of Being Earnest, right? But in a not unreal way, it is also this other place, right? Because as we talked about earlier, it is embodied. It does exist in space and time. So naturally, it's a place where people might start to have experiences that they might attribute to ghosts, right? Remnants of things that are no longer strictly there, but might be there in some sort of metaphorical sense, or which is actually also a real sense because of embodiment. Is that starting to make sense?
Yeah.
So you do things to propitiate these spirits, these ghosts, these demons, and you try very hard not to get on their nerves because they may interfere with the production of the play. And they could do that in any kind of way that would make it seem like, you know, some just normal thing where somebody falls off a catwalk and breaks their leg, or you know, a set falls down and hurts somebody. I mean, a lot of bad things can happen in the theater. It is a dangerous environment. It is physically dangerous, but it's also kind of psychically dangerous. And so although I can sit here right now with you, Josh, and say, I don't believe in ghosts, that's silly. You know, in the middle of the night when you're working in the theater and you hear some weird creaking or something, maybe you're not so sure.
Yeah, every time somebody tells me I believe or I don't, or every time somebody tells me I don't believe in one thing or another, I'm like, well, you don't know because you haven't been there yet. Maybe that day you're in the abandoned mental hospital and something touches you on the back, on your back, and you turn around and there's nothing there. Maybe that day you believe in ghosts.
Yeah, so, exactly. Or, yeah. You know, we've all had those nights where you wake up, it's 3 a.m. and you look at a pile of laundry, you know, and you think that is probably not a giant spider, but it might be. So I better sit very still, right? You know, or, you know, when we're kids, we certainly believed that our closets, which were perfectly fine in the daytime, were populated with monsters and that they were going to come and get us. We certainly believed it. And so I think that belief is a really tricky thing. You kind of move in and out of it, you know, all throughout the day. And when you're in a theater space, you think to yourself, well, I know there's no such thing as ghosts, but if there are, they're probably here. And so, you know, so why not just do that thing, you know, that little thing, spinning around or not saying the name of the Scottish play that you mentioned, or, you know, why not just do that? Because what is it going to cost you, really, you know, in the end? And so if you say, like, well, if it's a question of you know, not whistling when you cross the stage, or leaving that ghost light up to propitiate the ghosts. I mean, you leave the ghost light up to propitiate or to abjure the ghosts, but it also has the maybe side effect of being a light if you had to cross the stage in the middle of the night. You know, there, a dark stage is an extremely dangerous place. So having a ghost light up there is a basic safety requirement, right? And so we still do it to this day, even though, of course, nobody believes in ghosts. Ha ha, wink, wink, nod, nod, nudge, nudge.
Maybe that kind of takes us to, you know, a couple questions we can kind of wind down with, because I think I've kept you here about an hour or over it, and you've been extremely generous with your time. So I'll repay that. It really has. It's been a fantastic conversation. I've learned a lot, and so I'm gonna punish you with a couple questions. Therefore,
okay, great. Go for it.
One of them might be straightforward. The other one is simple and extremely difficult simultaneously. What monster scared you as a child, Dr. Michael Chimmers? And maybe if it's a different monster, what might you say is your favorite monster of all time?
So the answer to both questions is the werewolf.
You know, that's the most common answer I get, but everybody has different reasons. What are yours?
Well, I used to be terrified that the werewolf would eat me, right? When I was a little kid, there was a blue spruce tree outside my house that was really beautiful. But at night, it looked as if it were the heads of dozens of giant wolves. You know, with their jaws lolling, opening and closing when the breeze went through it, right? And of course, you know, Freud would have a lot to say about that. In fact, there's a wonderful article. Freud did have a character that was obsessed with wolves in one of his patients was called the Wolfman, and he had a dream about wolves. And there's a wonderful essay in Deleuze and Guattari's book, The Thousand Plateaus, called One Wolf or Many, which is a critique of Freud's analysis of that, which I find very, very powerful. But that's partially because I'm partial to werewolves. I was terrified of werewolves. I was so terrified of werewolves that I couldn't watch werewolf movies. Like, that's how scary they were to me. And then when I got to be in my 30s, actually, I think it was my 30s, I started to realize that what I was afraid of was not that the werewolf would eat me, but that I would become the werewolf. And what I was afraid of was that power to do what you want to do, to eat, to feed, to fight, to do other things. You know, nothing can stop the werewolf from doing that. And the main reason is because the werewolf has no sense that it's wrong. The werewolf just does what it does, right? It is free of guilt. It's free of shame. And I wanted that so much. I wanted to be free of guilt and shame and fear. And the werewolf is free of guilt and shame and fear when he's wolfed out, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted. And that scared me. That scared me. So once I realized that, I just realized that the werewolf is my favorite monster. And then I just devour werewolf movies. pun intended.
And
that's also... That's also partially why I turn into a werewolf while I'm teaching.
Yeah, you know? That's what I was going to say. And so now you embody this thing that scares you so deeply.
I do. It's very personal. And actually, you know, as I was going through my life, I also found that the image of the werewolf, the metaphor of the werewolf, was really helpful to me in sort of sorting out my own personal psychology and, you know, traumas of childhood and so on. You know, that the monster... part of the reason why we're attracted to the monster is because it has this anxiety relieving function. But I think if we get past that and we really start to examine our own greatest fears, greatest hopes for the future, the monster, for me, the werewolf, but for whatever it is, the monster that scares you the most is probably the one that has the greatest potential for therapeutic value for you, you know?
Yeah.
So let me ask you, Josh, what's your favorite monster or the monster that scares you the most? What is that?
Oh my God. Okay. So you're not allowed to turn this around on me. I'm the host here, but since you did, I can't avoid it.
We'll see about that.
Yeah. You know, I've filled up many, many minutes on the podcast already going nuts. And almost every time I do like a reading of my work as a fiction writer or something, somebody inevitably hits me with that question. And then everybody's in danger for the next 20 minutes as I have to act out and reenact the tragedy that is Fenrir, or the Fenris wolf out of Norse mythology. He is far and away my favorite. And but I won't go too much into that, because although many have heard that answer before and maybe why, I'm not really sure I ever shared what monster scared me most as a kid. And I'll try to be brief and say, first of all, everything scared me as a kid, and it's one of the reasons I do this podcast and I write I write, is I'm still afraid of everything in its own way. But I simultaneously enjoy that. But if I'm thinking back, the one that scared me so much that I felt attacked by a supernatural being, my fear was so great, was a witch who existed in the mirror who went by the name of Bloody Mary.
Ah, yes.
And when I was a kid, that was, it just got trendy for kids in school to like sneak out of class and go in elementary school and go into the bathroom and shut off all the lights and perform the summoning of Bloody Mary into the mirror ritual. And they were having to make special rules at these schools to stop the Bloody Mary summonings that were happening. And once that got in my head, a kid with already too much of an imagination, every mirror was a portal to hell, and she was coming for me, every reflective surface I was around. So for about a year and a half, I was severely traumatized by anything that had a reflective surface on it, because Bloody Mary was coming after me.
That's really cool, Josh. Let me offer this to you then. So I noticed that, you know, when you asked me to be on the podcast, and I was checking out what your podcast was all about, and which is great fun. I noticed that you have an image of Fenris Wolf on as your cover image for the podcast. I don't know what you call that.
Yeah.
And you can tell that it's Fenris because the god Tyr is putting his hand into his mouth.
Yeah.
That's how you know it's him. And that image of that wolf, I got to tell you, that very lean, hungry looking wolf, you know, is still very scary to me, you know. I think that if I could offer a suggestion or just an idea, both Bloody Mary and Fenris Wolf, the things that they have in common is that they are massive, evil, destructive powers that are nevertheless held in check. But the thing that holds them in check is very fragile and could come undone at any moment.
Oh, I like that a lot. I had never put that together. Oh man, maybe you just opened a door to one of my deep psychological or unconscious issues then.
Oh, that's what I do. Well, like, I mean, that's just a brief observation. You know, I think that if we talked about it for another hour, we could probably find some deeper connections there to things that happened to you when you were a child. But I really feel like the monster's potential as an object of therapy, if you really want to get into it and analyze it, I think it's really extraordinary.
I think we've made a lot of progress here today.
Well, good. Yeah, so same time next week.
No, this has really been a delight. It's a fantastic conversation. And for people listening to this and they want to find out more about you and more about your works, where should I send links to all this? Will be in the description below, where on whichever platform you're listening to it. But to give them an audio version of where they can find you, let us know. Where can we find more about you and your works?
Well, to my great shame, I do not have a Twitter account, nor do I have an Instagram, nor I haven't even been on Facebook in about 6 months because I've been writing. So I'm very embarrassed to say that I'm not current. However, we here at UCSC, we just founded something called the Center for Monster Studies. And this is going to be, we hope, a major center for people like you, Josh, to come and exchange ideas about monsters and do research and whatnot. And so we just got some money to found this, and that is going to have a website pretty soon. It doesn't right now, So I'm very sorry that there's very little that I can say. However, if you type my name, Michael M. Chemers or Michael Chemers, into Amazon, you will get a list of my books. And I think that's probably the best way to find out about what I'm doing.
Very cool. A Center for Monster Studies? I had no idea you guys were doing this. This is awesome.
And by the way, one of the things we're going to do is a podcast, and I really hope that you will be a guest on my podcast.
Oh, accept it automatically. That would be awesome. That would be a blast.
That's great.
Well, congrats on that. The Center for Monster Studies. I'm quite envious of that. Very cool.
I'll be a part of it. You know, you don't have to be envious. You can join it.
All right. I'm in. Well, thank you so much again. This has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you coming on the show. So thanks again, Dr. Michael Chemers.
Thank you so much. It's really been a real joy. Thank you.